an Italian take on our transgender debate today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. Italy's most prominent transgender politician knows what it's like to be barred from using a public restroom, and she doesn't think much of laws like the one passed in North Carolina.
Nobody cares about this. It's just a kind of propaganda. People are better than politics sometimes, normal people, I say.
Also, did Saudi Arabia support the 9/11 attacks?
There was a large part of the Saudi public, even people within the government, who supported Osama bin Laden and his terrorist network.
Plus, a Sudanese cartoonist in exile pushes boundaries.
With these cartoons, I'm trying to, you know, try to do the best that I can to create change so my kids can have a home, because I've always not been home.
It's all coming up today on The World. Thanks for being here. Transgender people and what bathroom they should use. It's a big debate in the U.S. right now. In a moment, we'll get a unique perspective on that from Italy's most prominent transgender politician. Her name is Vladimir Luxuria, a former member of the Italian parliament. She and other gay rights activists in Italy are celebrating today because yesterday the Italian parliament voted to approve civil unions for gay couples. Italy is the last major Western country to pass such legislation. Luxuria says she worked for years to get a law like this passed.
I was waiting for these days for such a long time. We've been waiting for 30 years to have such a law in Italy. So now it's time for celebration, but not only for the gay LGBT community, for all the people who believe in freedom, who believe in love. And now I feel more proud to be Italian. Before, I was feeling a little bit ashamed when I was talking with Spanish gay guy or an Argentinian lesbian girl who could say, we can do it in our own country and you cannot do it in Italy. Now I feel a little bit more part of my own country.
Now, this legislation legalizes civil unions for same-sex couples, but not actual marriage. Is that a disappointment for you?
Well, our aim is, of course, equal marriage. This is our final destination, let's say. But this is an important step. Now we know that we have reached this step, and from this step, our fight towards equality, full equality, is just begun.
There's news today that some right-wing politicians in Italy want to organize a referendum to repeal the civil union law that was just passed. What do you think about that?
The same happened in the 70s with the law about divorce, when
it has been
possible to divorce in Italy. And they lost it. And now I'm sure that they will fail because families and people understand that when you grant rights to other people, this doesn't mean that they take off something from you. So I'm not afraid of this referendum, to be honest.
What is your own story of gender identity? I know you identify as a woman, but you still go by Vladimir, correct?
Yes, I decided to keep my name because I like the sound, and I think that the sound can be feminine or masculine.
Mm.
But my appearance is feminine. I like to be referred as she rather than he. I'm a transgender. I'm fine. And I try to live in harmony with my gender identity and with the fact that you can choose what you want to be and your gender cannot be conceived as a cage.
What is the word for transgender in Italian?
Transgender. We use this word, the transgender.
You use the English
which
word.
Which has Latin origin, you know, transut, gender as a genere. So we like to keep these words, which has etymologically Latin origins.
Finally, Vladimir, I just wanted to get your take on the debate that's going on in this country about access to bathrooms for transgender people, specifically this law in North Carolina that Washington is now trying to override. Have you been following this case, and what do you think about it?
Oh, yes, of course, because when I was member of the Italian parliament, the same happened to me. I was in the ladies' bathroom, and a member of the Italian parliament, a woman from the right wing, entered into the bathroom and she tried to throw me out. You are a man and you should not be in the ladies' toilet. And so there has been a kind of discussion, a debate in the Italian parliament. And at last, what they have decided in the Italian parliament that I was right to go to the ladies' toilet because of the gender identity. So I can understand the kind of humiliation that transgender women must feel when they are compelled to go into men's toilet. And it is more embarrassing for men into the men's toilet to see a woman, a transgender woman, coming into the toilet. I think nobody cares about this. It's just a kind of propaganda, a hate law. So women in the ladies' toilet don't feel ashamed or embarrassed when they see a transgender woman. People are better than politics sometimes, normal people, I say.
How did you deal with that incident in the ladies' room at the Italian Parliament back in the day? And are those experiences a thing of the past today for you?
When I saw this member of the Italian Parliament, this lady shouting, pointing her finger towards me, I told her, if you don't want to see me in the ladies' toilet, then I advise you to go to the men's toilet next time.
And today, do you have any of these issues still when you go to the ladies' room?
No, there is a big invention called door. And this door can even be closed. Where can you imagine? So when you go to the ladies' toilet, you go into your room, you have your privacy. Nobody cares. Last time I went to the ladies' toilet, the lady next to me asked me if I could lend my brush. So no problem.
Oh, and you pass it over?
Yes, of course.
Vladimir Luxuria, former member of the Italian Parliament, thanks for speaking with us today.
Thank you.
The North Carolina bathroom debate is a serious one, but spare a thought for the tens of millions of women in places like India who've essentially got no access to any bathrooms. India's Prime Minister Narendra Modi promised to take this on when he was elected 2 years ago. Reporter and friend of the show, Ritu Chatterjee, grew up in India and has covered this story for The World. Ritu, how has that effort and the promises Prime Minister Modi made actually played out so far?
Well, over a million toilets have been planned or built so far, Marco, in the past couple of years. But the interesting thing here is even where toilets have been built, surveys and studies are showing the vast majority are not being used by people, especially in rural areas. So, you know, building toilets is not the answer. You need to connect the toilets to sewers. You need to have regular water supply, and you need to have really widespread education efforts to change the culture of open defecation.
And just remind us of the scale of the problem of toilet access in India.
India has about 1.2 billion people, and I think about 60% people still defecate in the open. Some studies show that about 70% of Indian households, especially in rural areas, don't have access to toilets. So that's the scale we are talking about. And the consequences, of course, are huge.
I know you go back to India often, Ritu, and I know you've got access to places and resources that most Indian women don't. But still, you must occasionally have to deal with this challenge.
Marco, this is a very personal issue for every Indian girl and woman. Women like me who grew up in urban, educated, middle-class households with access to toilets, but as soon as you leave the security of your home, you don't have access to toilets. I remember in school, most of my girlfriends and I would hardly ever use the school toilet.
And why wouldn't you use a toilet at school? It's just inadequate?
Yeah, you know, there wasn't regular water supply and it just wasn't clean. And in rural areas and in poorer areas, in urban areas, lack of access to clean toilets and water and sanitation is a big cause for girls dropping out of schools or not going to school at all.
So what do women and girls do? I mean, you do have to relieve yourself at some point.
Yeah, you just get used to just not going, holding back for hours. It's just how you grow up. It's just conditioning. You've traveled in India and you know that it's completely opposite for men. You know, you find men peeing everywhere, even in urban areas. Middle-class educated men, you know, if they have to go, they stop the car or whatever they're traveling in and they'll pee against a wall.
Yeah, or not just urination, but, you know, number two as well. Prime Minister Modi's initiative has been unsuccessful so far. Do you see any signs of change on this?
Well, I think the big change, Marco, is him talking about this has created a lot more awareness, you know, where people are at least thinking about it. But I think unless a deeper and a more cultural change is brought about, it's only going to result in millions of dollars wasted in building toilets that no one uses.
Journalist and friend of the world, Ritu Chatterjee, speaking with me from New York. Thank you, Ritu.
Thanks, Marco.
Let me take you to Brazil for what seems like our now daily dose of political chaos in the country. After a marathon 20-hour Senate session, lawmakers this morning voted to suspend the deeply unpopular President Dilma Rousseff. She's now set to face trial for breaking financial rules. Rousseff fired back in an address to the nation saying the suspension was fraudulent and amounted to a coup. The World's Will Carlos joins us from Rio. Suspension, Will tells me, is not quite the same thing as Rousseff being impeached.
What this basically means is that she sort of stands down. She basically is no longer the acting president, and she'll be taken over by the vice president, Michel Temer. She will be going on trial, which means that she has to sort of present evidence and give her defense. And then at the end of 180 days, or about 6 months, they will hold another vote in the Senate. And if two-thirds of senators vote for her impeachment, at that point, she is actually impeached. She's forced out. She is no longer president.
Well, as you said, Vice President Michel Temer is taking over for Rousseff, but he's also under investigation for financial misconduct. What's he been accused of?
Basically the same thing. I mean, this all comes down to whether or not Rousseff was giving orders to move money around in government accounts. It's basically creative accounting. The point is that on certain overseas trips, Michel Temer was the acting president, and he, it's alleged, did the same thing that Rousseff did. So the point is, if she can be impeached for this, he can too. That's the legal side of it. Of course, there's a political side to this. In order to bring this impeachment trial against the president, you need a two-thirds vote of Congress. And it's not believed that that would happen against Temer. He's coming into power with sort of quite a lot of support and a pretty wide mandate.
So Michel Temer's from a different party than Dilma Rousseff. What will a Temer presidency look like for Brazil?
All signs show that it will be a little bit more centrist. I mean, he's seen as a more business-friendly candidate, comes from a less liberal party. The context of this, though, is that he's kind of hamstrung. I mean, he doesn't have very long to do very much. He also needs to keep an awful lot of allies happy. So we really don't know.
How long will he be in office?
If she sticks around for the full 180 days and then is voted out, then he will take over sort of more permanently until the next round of elections in 2018. He's sitting pretty.
And Dilma Rousseff right now, she essentially under house arrest. Where is she staying and what is her legal status as a federal rule breaker?
She's certainly not under arrest. She hasn't been found guilty of anything yet. So she's more sort of on vacation. In fact, there was a great trending hashtag in Brazil. You know, what would you do if you were Dilma? with all of these kind of suggestions of wild and wacky ways to go off and, I don't know, learn scuba diving or learn the piano or something. So what she'll be doing is fighting for her political survival. She's teamed up with former President Lula, her predecessor, and she's going to probably be working with him very, very hard to keep drumming up support and try and get her job back.
Fighting for political survival and in a couple of months probably fighting for Olympics tickets.
Well, I don't think she'll have to fight very hard for those. There's plenty of those on the market, yeah.
Our Brazil correspondent Will Carlos joining us from Rio. Thank you.
Thank you.
You're with the world.
Support for The World's podcast comes from Goldman Sachs. For answers to the world's most pressing economic questions, from the evolution of consumer preferences to the reasons for price swings in the oil market, tune into Exchanges at Goldman Sachs, the firm's podcast. Each episode features in-depth discussions with some of the firm's leading experts on the markets, evolving industries, and the global economy. Subscribe to Exchanges at Goldman Sachs on iTunes, Stitcher, or SoundCloud, or listen at gs.com/podcast.
The story of civil rights in America is an unfinished one, but it still inspires Khalid Al-Bey. Al-Bey is a political cartoonist from Sudan, and he recently finished a road trip across America. The reason for that road trip? He wanted to visit places that played a key role in civil rights history and to learn more about the civil rights heroes he feels can provide models for change back home. The World's Carol Hill spoke with Khalid Al-Bey at the end of his journey.
When I caught up with Khalid Al-Bey via Skype, he was staying in a treehouse in West Memphis. I'm not kidding. You'll hear the birds chirping. The day before, he'd visited the National Civil Rights Museum at the Lorraine Motel in Memphis, where Martin Luther King Jr. was assassinated in 1968. Al-Bey is a political satirist who uses cartoons to fight for civil rights and human rights across the Arab and Muslim world. He thought this road trip might lift his spirits.
I think what attracted me most about the trip was the development that happened in the United States through the civil rights movement, you know, from not having a chair in a bus to having a black president. And that for me was really amazing in such a short time, even though with all the troubles and that's still going on.
Politics has determined Albay's life. He's Sudanese, but lives in exile in Qatar. His father was a diplomat who was fired by Sudan's military government in 1989. His mother was political, too. She campaigned against female genital mutilation. Albay's choice of political activism are his cartoons, which rarely have captions. In many ways, he's trying to convey what he can't or isn't allowed to say with words.
Politics was a big part of why I don't have a home, and is a big part of why I don't have a home. And I'm trying to understand it really more than anything else. And with these cartoons, I'm trying to, you know, try to do the best that I can to create change so my kids can have a home, because I've always not been home.
Albay's civil rights road trip took him to famous black entertainment districts like Harlem. He also visited Freedom Rider stops and the place where in 1966 Stokely Carmichael broke ranks with civil disobedience and made a speech about black power. But the site that meant the most to Albay was the Malcolm X and Betty Shabazz Center in New York, which is in the building that used to house the Audubon Ballroom, where Malcolm X was assassinated in 1965. Albay says when he was growing up black, African, and Muslim, it was reading Malcolm X's autobiography and seeing Spike Lee's film that changed his life.
We don't really have heroes in the Arab world right now and in the Muslim region. We don't have that character that young people can look up to. Our heroes have only been religious heroes, which are like holy figures that never made a mistake.
Malcolm X provided an alternative role model, a real person who was flawed and dared to change his mind.
He's an amazing character that went through so many changes, and which is very human to me.
Albay timed his trip to coincide with the American elections. And between the lofty lessons he learned at each stop on his civil rights tour, he made sure to speak with regular Americans.
The one thing I noticed about America is that everybody's trying to be as politically correct as they can. And I think Donald Trump came, and he's the person that's not politically correct. He's the person that's saying all the things that I think a lot of people want to be saying, but they're not.
Albay was stunned and slightly depressed when he spoke to the neighbors of the place in Mississippi where Stokely Carmichael made his famous speech, only to learn that they didn't know anything about it.
They had no idea what's going on, and they didn't care, really. So for me, it's that. It's that the younger generation is taking all these rights for granted. And I think this was set America back. It's that. I mean, if you don't know your own rights and if you don't know how you got here, it's going to take time for you to understand what's happening right now.
And right now, Albay wanted to be able to cheerlead over one of the civil rights struggle's greatest achievements, President Barack Obama, as he finishes his waning months in office. But he can't. Albay was excited when Obama was elected in 2008. He loved the Cairo speech about the Muslim world and can't help but like Obama's wit, his oratory and personality. But as a citizen of the Arab and Muslim world, there's one giant thing that gets in the way. Drones.
The amount of people that were killed with the drone program that Obama gave power to is unbelievable. I mean, and the records really don't show anything. We have no idea how many people died and for what.
During his trip, Albay drew a cartoon of Obama. He showed him doing his famous mic drop at the end of his last White House Correspondents' Dinner. But instead of a mic, he's dropping drones. For The World, I'm Carol Hills.
We've got some of Khalid's cartoons up on our Tumblr, including the one of Obama dropping drones. To see them, just head over to pritheworld.tumblr.com. Pop music is everywhere around the globe, especially the stuff you and I know, Anglo-American-Canadian pop from Beyoncé to Bieber to Adele. Its popularity is so huge, it makes life competitive for musicians around the world trying to get airplay on their own country's radio stations. South Africa has a plan, though. The national broadcaster, SABC, has unveiled a new quota system. It will require that 90% of the music played on its 18 radio stations be the work of local musicians. Commercial stations in South Africa will still be able to play what they want. BBC online correspondent Pumza Fishani is with me now. What is the aim of the SABC in doing this, Pumza?
Well, what they're aiming to do, Marco, they're saying they want to show what the musical industry is capable of doing. Artists have been calling for this for a number of years, so they are very pleased that it has finally happened. But more than artists, South Africans themselves who have taken to social media to celebrate the move say that it's going to be great to hear music that is produced in their local languages.
Mm. So presumably this will raise profiles of South African artists, not to mention revenues from music sales. But this is just the SABC. I know it's got 18 radio stations, but will it make a difference?
They believe it will. So the SABC is the public broadcaster, and it's got about 30 million listeners per week. And they're hoping that that is enough to introduce new artists to listeners, to show that there are new offerings that are coming up and encourage them to go out and buy this music. It's a 3-month trial period. So the listeners, again, will get to decide if they like what they've heard over the 3-month period and if they want that to be made a permanent decision.
Wow. So the listeners will make the final call on this?
Correct. After a 3-month period, what the SABC is hoping to do is to either looking at listenership patterns to be able to decide if the audiences liked the change that they made.
So for our listeners who may think of kind of township jive as what South African music is, just remind us of the diversity of music down there. I mean, are there enough different styles that South Africa can provide the full spectrum of sounds to fill that 90% quota?
So what they're looking at doing, they're looking at not just focusing on what is traditionally known as Kwaito music, which is sort of like a dance style music, which is what you're talking about. Mm. But there's also been a massive boom of South African hip hop, which has influences from American hip hop. But the difference is the sound is a bit different, but also it's produced in local languages. So that's going to be one of the genres that they focus on. They're also looking at focusing on jazz, which has been around in South Africa for many, many years.
BBC online correspondent Phumza Fishane, thank you so much.
You're most welcome.
Hip-hop, jazz, Kwaito. I hope the SABC doesn't forget about the country's own smoldering indie rock scene. Here's the band Blackjacks from a few years ago, a track called Lakeside. If you recognize it, chances are you're a fan of the soccer video game FIFA 10. Blackjacks licensed Lakeside for the game soundtrack. Want a few more suggestions for great music from South Africa? Head over to PRI.org. We've got a list of some South African musicians you should already be listening to. Listening to the world. I'm Marco Werman. William Yu wanted people to imagine more Asian actors playing leading roles in Hollywood, so he created the Starring John Cho hashtag and Twitter account. And it seems to have struck a chord. He even heard from actor John Cho himself.
3 days ago, he tweeted us an emoji heart.
The guy behind Starring John Cho, that's ahead here on the world.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from TIAA. Whether it's investing, advice, banking, or retirement, TIAA is committed to helping those who do good do well. You can learn more at TIAA.org.
I'm Marco Werman, and you're tuned to The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. You may know John Cho from the Harold and Kumar movies. He's one of the stars, plays Harold, the always aggravated straight guy to Cal Penn's pot-smoking antics as Kumar. John Cho also plays Sulu in the rebooted Star Trek series. Now, some critics see John Cho and say, what, just Harold and Sulu? John Cho's talented. He should be getting roles that push him beyond that range. Enter William Yu, a digital strategist in New York. And William, you started this project you call Starring John Cho. It's now a hashtag that's been getting a lot of traction online. Explain what you did and why you did it.
Sure. So with Starring John Cho, I really had the idea of thinking about what would it look like if we had John Cho or an Asian American lead portraying the lead roles in Hollywood. So what I did is that I took a lot of images of John Cho's face and using Photoshop, put him on top of some of the most recognizable movie posters to show that an Asian American leading man isn't quite so shocking, or it's not quite that hard to really see someone filling that role.
Describe some of the movie posters that you have photoshopped. What movies did you go for, and why'd you choose them?
I wanted to pick movies that were very recognizable, that people had already either had gone to see or were looking forward to seeing this year. So, you know, looking at some of the top grossing movies of the past few years, I selected movies like Avengers, Age of Ultron, selected Mission Impossible, Rogue Nation, Jurassic World, you know, movies that require a big name figure. And also looking towards next year, or this year, I should say, You're looking at movies like Me Before You or The Nice Guys. So movies that, you know, have a lot of hype around them and people, large audiences are excited to see are movies that I targeted to try and make sure that we could get John Cho's face in there.
Have you heard from John Cho since he started this project?
Not personally. What was great is that actually on the first day of launch, John actually followed the account, which is really was just really incredible. And 3 days ago, he tweeted us an emoji heart, which was a nice acknowledgement. Beyond that, I haven't heard anything from him otherwise.
There was, as you know, Oscar So White. Then people realize Oscar is also not really that brown either, nor Asian. So we also know how hard it is for women actors in Hollywood once they get past 35, not to mention what a slog it is for women directors. You must have some thoughts about why Hollywood has not really been able to tackle diversity. What is your opinion?
I think it's a very tough question. I think there's definitely a perception type issue where, you know, a lot of individuals aren't able to imagine or envision an Asian American or someone from an underrepresented community playing those roles. And I think, you know, that's what starring John Cho is trying to hope to help continue the conversation is by showing you and giving you a very visual and tangible representation of what such a thing might look like and hopefully having the reaction be, oh, it's actually not quite so outrageous or quite so ludicrous to think that someone with that background can play those roles.
It was also interesting to see your take on John Cho playing James Bond, especially after the big debate last year whether Idris Elba could be a Bond. Do you think audiences are more open to diversity than Hollywood thinks their audiences are?
I certainly think that, yeah, that's definitely the case. Especially just considering the reactions that I think that starring John Cho has received, there's definitely been an outpouring of support from both Asians and non-Asians that really resonates with them, the thought of having John Cho play these lead roles. And I think not only people just saying, you know, this is something that I like or this is something that is cool, but this is something that I would pay to see. This is something I would buy tickets for. And this is a movie that if John Cho had been cast, I would have gone to see it as opposed to not seeing it at all.
Tell me a bit about your own background, especially like growing up and what you saw on movie screens that, you know, maybe is something behind what you started here with this project.
Yeah, there definitely was a connection, a personal connection to starting starring John Cho. You know, I'm Korean American, so I've grown up in the States. And for me, you know, as a person who does have a passion for film and TV, there was always, you know, the lack of representation of Asian Americans in Hollywood has always been top of mind for me. And I think, you know, it was always as a child growing up, there weren't many examples, if any examples, to really have to serve as role models or people that I wanted to emulate. So I think that was something that was lacking in my maturity or my maturing as an adult. I do think, you know, with starring John Cho, it's one of the greater discussions that we're having is that as much as it is about Hollywood, this is also just a social issue of how we perceive Asian Americans in our society. And I think, you know, for children or for kids or teens who are growing up and watching movies, especially Asian American teens, you know, it's hard for them to set goals that they want to strive for and want to try to emulate if they're not seeing that represented on screen.
William Yu, the man behind the hashtag and the faux movie posters starring John Cho, which aims to highlight the lack of diversity in Hollywood. William, thank you for speaking with us.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me.
From The Martian to Jurassic Park, we've got some of our favorite starring John Cho posters up on our website. To see them, just head over to PRI.org. Here's a question for you. Which U.S. state has the worst performing public schools in the country? The answer is Nevada. State lawmakers there want to change that, and one solution they'd like to try, provide taxpayer money for kids to attend private schools. The Republican-led Nevada legislature passed a law that gives parents at least $5,100 a year for private school tuition. But a group of parents is challenging that law in court. They say public money is for public schools, and that the law discriminates against low-income families, including immigrants. From Las Vegas, the world's Jason Margolis has our story.
Alicia Partida has two kids who go to public elementary schools in Las Vegas. She wants them out. She says her kids' teachers are always changing. Her daughter had three in the same academic year, and the classrooms are too crowded. Partida moved to Nevada from Mexico 12 years ago. When Nevada passed the law last year promising parents like her money for private schools or homeschooling, Partida was renewed with hope. She wants to send her children to a local Christian school.
porque quiero que puedan ellos ir a la universidad.
She says she wants a better life for her kids. She wants her children to attend college and to avoid the violence and drugs in her neighborhood. Nobody is arguing against Partida's dreams. Jennifer Carr understands her frustration. She has three kids in Las Vegas public schools, but is also one of the parents suing to stop Nevada's new voucher law.
I think we both agree that there are problems with the public schools, right? Nevada ranks 51st in the nation. Like, 51st, right? Like, there are 50 states. We rank 51st. That's hard, right? It's hard to get up in the morning and send your kids to public school.
Carr also knows that Nevada ranks towards the bottom in per-pupil spending. She'd like to address that issue, not create educational savings accounts, or ESAs, to give people money for private schools.
And I think the problem with the ESA is it's basically throwing up your hands and saying it's not fixable and, you know, abandoning the public school in favor of some other option. But the problem is a lot of people don't have that other option.
She says that because the vouchers don't cover the full cost of tuition at most public schools in Clark County, where Las Vegas is located.
One of the things that we have found out through our research is that there's only about seven schools where a $5,100 voucher will actually cover full tuition.
Sylvia Lazos is a law professor at UNLV and policy director of the group Educate Nevada Now. She says the lack of affordable private schools for low-income parents is just the start of the problem.
And then on top of that, you have transportation. How do you get your child to school every day? And most of these schools are going to be located not where our immigrant community live.
Perhaps 30 states have some type of school choice program, such as vouchers or educational savings accounts. Most states impose eligibility requirements, though. Nevada's law does not. Students do need to be registered for 100 days in a public school before they could access public funds for private school. Lazos and others argue that bar is too low and that Nevada's new law would amount to a subsidy for the rich already planning to use private schools.
When you're using taxpayer funds, that is for public schools. If you want to do private schools, use your private funds for that.
More than 5,000 applications for the vouchers have been filed statewide. If the law passes, the program could cost Clark County more than $17 million in its first year. Opponents argue that covering those costs means hurting already underfunded programs like English language learning classes. Maybe so, but Coco Llenas, an immigrant from the Dominican Republic, says it's time to shake things up. She's the director of a group called Nevada School Choice Partnership, which supports vouchers for private schools.
I personally have been in Las Vegas for 18 years, and the situation in public education today is worse than 18 years ago. It's not getting any better. Competition might be healthy for the school district. It's healthy for anybody.
She says children stuck in bad schools, they need better resources right now.
In an ideal world, public schools will be awesome. They will have the best teachers. They will have all the resources they need. Kids will succeed, move forward. But the reality of Nevada is that it's far from getting to that point. And while we get there, in the meantime, our children are not succeeding. And they don't have the time until it gets right.
The legal challenge against Nevada's new law is making its way through the courts. A final resolution might not come until next spring. For The World, Jason Margolis, Las Vegas.
Here's a big question Washington officials are wrestling with right now, and not for the first time. It goes like this. Saudi Arabia, American friend or enemy?
The Saudis have provided the United States with important strategic value over the years, but there is real reason to believe that before 9/11, surely, there was a large part of the Saudi public, even people within the government, who supported Osama bin Laden and his terrorist network at a time when Osama bin Laden was clearly gunning for the United States.
That's Philip Sheenan. He's the author of The Commission, The Uncensored History of the 9/11 Investigation. You might have heard about 28 pages in a congressional report about the 9/11 attacks that remain classified. Those pages have been getting a lot of attention lately. Some U.S. officials want them to be declassified, but others don't. I asked Philip Sheenan to tell me more about those 28 pages.
They were prepared by a special congressional panel that was formed almost immediately after 9/11. We understand that they are the raw information developed mostly by the FBI pointing to individual Saudis in the United States who may have been linked to the hijackers.
What about this split between Washington officials over those who want to release these, make them public or keep them classified? Why are some people saying these 28 pages should be declassified?
Well, certainly the people who are saying that 28 pages should be declassified include lots of the family members of victims on 9/11 who believe that they're entitled to all the information that the government had about a possible terrorist network that existed in the United States before 9/11 that may have contributed support to the hijackers while they lived here. There are people certainly at the CIA and elsewhere in the government who believe that the information is just too raw, that it's just it points to people who were eventually found to be innocent of any ties to the 9/11 hijackers, and that it might unfairly implicate the government of Saudi Arabia in 9/11.
Now, the commissioner who's brought this up, John Lehman, what do you know about him? Is he a loose cannon? Is he prone to exaggeration? Like, would he overemphasize what's in those 28 pages?
No, not at all. And I think he's saying what other 9/11 commissioners have been saying privately, which is that the 9/11 commission report, which came a couple of years after the 28 pages, was never meant to be an exoneration of Saudi Arabia, and that there is a tremendous amount of evidence to suggest that Saudis on the ground in the United States before 9/11, including employees of the Saudi government, were involved in some sort of support network for at least two of the hijackers.
And how solid is the evidence that those people did that, did support al-Qaeda?
I think people who've gone over that material will tell you that there's pretty compelling evidence that people on the Saudi payroll were involved. So they sort of stepped forward from nowhere to help these two hijackers who live openly in San Diego in the year before the attack. And I think there's a lot of questioning now, even among members of the 9/11 Commission, about why they didn't spell that out more directly in their final report.
Is there any evidence that Saudi officials higher than diplomats supported al-Qaeda? I mean, how high does this go?
I think the evidence that was most compelling that was developed by the 9/11 Commission pointed to low-level, mid-level folks. And I think the 9/11 commissioners, including John Lehman, who you just mentioned, are quite clear that they're not saying that the Saudi government as a whole or the Saudi royal family was somehow implicated in 9/11.
I'm most curious about why this has all come up now, all these years after 9/11, 2001, and 12 years after the commission issued that final report.
Well, there's certainly been a number of large news reports about this in just the last few weeks, including by 60 Minutes on CBS. There was also this very tense meeting a couple of weeks ago between President Obama and the Saudi leaders in Saudi Arabia. There's a sense that maybe the relationship with Saudi Arabia is particularly rocky, that Saudi Arabia has not been a good ally to the United States in many different ways in recent years. And if there is incriminating information tying Saudi Arabia to the worst terrorist attack this nation's ever faced, this is the moment to release it.
I mean, aside from that tension, we know the U.S.-Saudi relationship has always been complicated, to put it mildly. Do you think there's some kind of fundamental shift happening right now in Washington with regards to Saudi Arabia?
Clearly there is, and part of it has to do with the fact that for generations, this nation's relationship with Saudi Arabia has involved oil. That oil is not so important to the United States anymore, and I think that's created an important strategic rethinking of our relationship to Saudi Arabia.
Philip Sheenan is a writer based in Washington. He wrote about the 28 pages of the 9/11 congressional report for the Guardian newspaper. Philip, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. We've been thinking a lot lately about air quality and how cars and industry are making some places unbreathable. The World Health Organization has been thinking a lot about the problem, too. The UN agency said today that more than 80% of the world's urban residents live in cities with unhealthy air, and that the problem overall is getting worse. We're going to pay a visit in a couple of minutes to Mexico City, a place that struggled with bad air for decades. But first, how about a visit to a place with clean air? Really clean air, maybe the cleanest of any urban area in the world. We found this place in an article today in The Guardian, and we called up a couple of people who could tell us about it.
I'm Pianti. I'm a senior research scientist at the Finnish Meteorological Institute.
Pia Anttila knows all about the air in Mornio, a city in far northern Finland.
It's among the cleanest areas on Earth.
Not surprising, perhaps, since Mornio is barely a city at all. It's got just a couple of thousand residents. And Antila says Mornio's air quality monitoring station is actually in the middle of a national park. She was there last month.
Only hills. Not a living person. I couldn't see in within tens of kilometers.
You do have reindeers and you have all sorts of animals there and lots of lovely hiking tracks.
Nina Wigley is an actual human resident of Mornio. She and her husband William, he's British, moved there to raise their family precisely because there's nothing there but nature.
So we can literally walk out our front door and literally, you know, in a minute we are able to go into the forest.
That's actually why authorities put the air monitoring station there in the first place. Researcher Pia Antila says it's a place with virtually no local air pollution.
There are no local emissions. There are no regional emissions even. And all the things that we measure, all the things that we detect, they are long-range transported.
But even in Mornio, there are traces of pollutants, things like PCBs and sulfur dioxide that blow in from farther south in Europe and even from the United States. So even the cleanest urban area on Earth is not untouched by air pollution. Now to a whiff of the air in an entirely different place, Mexico City. Mexico's capital has dealt with bad air for decades. Over time, it's gotten better, it's gotten worse, and right now, it's worse. Here's the world's Monica Campbell.
This nursery school in Mexico City is bustling on a recent morning. But like many other schools and nurseries here, this place recently shut down for a day for an air pollution emergency. When it reopened, kids were kept indoors for days.
No salir al patio.
Catalina Guardado works at the nursery. We kept the windows and doors closed, she says. The kids went stir crazy. But better that than risking their still developing lungs. Air quality has generally improved here in Mexico's capital over the last 20 years or so. Back in the 90s, people said living here was like smoking two packs of cigarettes a day. And in the 80s...
then it was much worse.
Gabriela Alarcón researches pollution at a Mexico City think tank.
What we saw was birds that suddenly fell down.
Fell out of the sky.
Yes, they fell out of the sky and they were dead.
Since then, the city has pushed out big refineries, banned leaded gas, and built more public transportation. It all made a difference for a while. But now things seem to be backsliding. More than three quarters of the days so far this year have been considered bad air days. The thing is, despite all those improvements, Mexico City's population continues to grow, up roughly 10% over the last decade to more than 21 million. Most new residents live on the outskirts, and Alarcón says more sprawl means
longer trips with more people driving cars.
About 200,000 more cars are on the road every year here. A lot of them are new and cleaner, but a lot are still dirty. And Alarcón says many of those who don't drive rely on old, dirty buses. Her solution?
The best bet is to increase the quality and the quantity of public transportation.
But plans for new buses and subways are way behind. So for now, the city is doubling down on a program that takes cars off the road once a week. Alarcón says that plan, it's just a band-aid. City officials acknowledge that they're having trouble keeping up with the air pollution problem, but they also say it needs to be put in context.
For example, China, there's a huge difference between 100 parts per billion of ozone and 350 or 400.
Tanya Mueller-Garcia is Mexico City's environment chief. She says the city is doing better than many of the world's megacities, and she points out an important difference here from years past.
We've strengthened the levels at which we say we have bad air quality.
In other words, standards have tightened, so a bad air day now might not be the same as a bad air day years ago. That's partly because we've learned a lot since the 80s about how air pollution can harm people. How does the air look to you today? You have an expert eye.
It's quite sunny, it's warm, and this is known as the ozone season, no?
Miquel Grutter de la Mora runs a big pollution monitoring station on a roof in the southern part of the city.
He says ozone pollution can be very dangerous, but he worries about something else.
The smaller particles like benzene or toluene, and as you know, these compounds are carcinogenic.
Small particles are a complex group of pollutants that share a key feature.
They are sufficiently small that they reach our lungs and they can be inserted into our bloodstream.
Along with possibly causing cancer, long-term exposure to small particles can make asthma worse, hurt kids' cognitive and emotional development, even cause premature death. But, Gruder says, Mexico City's new air pollution crisis actually has an upside.
There's one good thing coming out of this, that conscience is being made by the people and they start to think about it.
It's definitely on the mind of Catalina Guardado at the nursery. She says, when the air was really bad, she noticed this about the kids.
Pues empezó a ver problemitas ya como tipo gripa.
They all seemed to have flu symptoms, runny noses, headaches, she says. But she couldn't tell, was it the flu or the air? If it's the air, she says, she wants more done about it, not just some cars taken off the streets until the rainy season comes and the air gets better for just a while. For the World, Monica Campbell, Mexico City.
And that is The World Today. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH here in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. We're back with you tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.